From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Chris Anderson says the future can be terrifying.
A lot of people feel it. We look at a future with 10 billion people teeming across the planet. A lot of people in the environmental movement have spent a lot of the last 30 years terrified of cities and really hating the process of urbanization. What's, I think, remarkable about what's happened in the last 10 years, say, is that there's been a groundswell change of opinion here from cities being this great evil to being the thing that may save humanity, that may be humanity's best hope.
Chris Anderson is the curator of the TED Conference. This year it awarded the annual TED Prize to a concept, not a person. The idea? The city, 2.0.
I guess my lens on a lot of this has been being at TED and seeing some people talk. Robert Neurath was one of the speakers who came. He's written a book called Maximum City, and he was talking about slums. I've always thought of slums as these sort of hellholes of awfulness. He had actually talked to lots of people in slums and heard their stories of, in many cases, excitement and hope, and the fact that they saw city living, and being in the slum to them was city living, as their opportunity to escape from poverty. They are hives of innovation. You know, when you put the camera right back and look at what's happening, in the next 50 to 70 years, humanity will have to build as much urban living space as it has in all of history so far. It's astonishing. The numbers are approximately a million people a week, every week, for the next 70 years will move into cities. What that means is that humanity has a chance to reorganize itself. And so there's absolutely everything to play for here. This is not just a topic about, oh, let's make urban life a little bit more attractive. This is about trying to use the very best of human imagination, inventiveness, to get to a future that our planet can support.
Cities are us, so to speak. Cities are the origin, if you like, of almost all of our so-called problems, our big challenges from the environment, global warming, questions of finance, disease, energy, resources. All of these things are all generated in cities. On the other hand, the solutions to the problems are also generated in cities, because that's where the smart people are. That's where ideas, innovation, and wealth are generated. So there's an urgency to having a theory of cities.
Jeffrey West has taken on that task. He's bringing his theoretical physicist's mind to the questions of urbanization. He told Steve Paulson that he's trying to discover the
quantitative, predictive, analytic theory of cities. And the question is that possible? Or maybe that isn't possible at all, and we'll just have to stick with the traditional, more qualitative, narrative ways in which people have thought about cities.
So you actually want to come up with laws,
yes,
general
so
laws
is,
that apply
there laws?
To all cities?
So that's the question. Are there any generic, kind of universal, in quotes, laws that govern the growth, organization, and evolution of cities? So the work that I got involved with was just looking at data, various metrics that characterize cities, like the length of all its roads, the length of its electrical lines, the number of AIDS cases per year, the amount of violent crime, anything you could think of where you could get data. If you looked at that as a function of city size, is it kind of all over the place, expressing that every city is really unique, which is the way it feels, or is there some regularity saying that even though it feels unique, it's actually behaving in a highly constrained, almost predictive way? And one of the things we discovered was that there was this extraordinary regularity. You tell me the size of a city in the United States, I can tell you with, you know, 85% certainty how many police it has, the length of its roads, how many AIDS cases it, quote, should have.
Now, as we look at cities around the world, it seems like they're getting bigger and mm-hmm. bigger and bigger. From a physicist's
yeah.
perspective, is there an inherent reason why cities should get bigger? Is
yes.
there some advantage to that?
Yeah. So in biology, these scaling laws are such that, for example, what you might have expected is that if you had one mammal twice the size of another, it would require twice as much energy. That's not the case at all. These scaling laws say, roughly speaking, that if one is twice the size of the other, it actually only requires about 75%. So there's this extraordinary economy of scale. If you go to cities, you find there is a similarity to that in terms of infrastructure. The bigger the city, the less infrastructure it needs per capita in a systematic way.
You don't need twice the number of
roads. You don't need twice the number of roads. You don't need twice the number of gas stations, twice the amount of electrical lines, and so on. The law there is roughly that it's about 15% saving.
Certainly one of the most influential thinkers about cities over the past century was Jane Jacobs. And one of her ideas was that the city works like an organism. Yeah. Do you think she's basically right?
Well, so I came with the view that it was just like an organism, which turned out to be wrong. And so to some extent, a city is an organism. Metaphorically, certainly, that are like organisms. It grows, it adapts, it evolves. However, in the very thing that is a city and the very thing that Jane Jacobs emphasized, the city is people. And it turns out the people side of the equation is not like organisms. A new dynamic was introduced to the planet when people started talking to one another and working together, discovering economies of scale, but then, more importantly, being innovative. If you ask about these metrics that are associated with the social networks, like amount of wages you get, the number of AIDS cases, the number of patents produced, these kinds of things which are socioeconomic and involve the interaction between human beings, if you ask about those, you see a phenomenon that if you double the size, instead of getting less of something, you get more. So if you double the size of a city, you get about 15% per capita increase of the wages, the average wealth, the number of AIDS cases, the number of patents produced, the number of police, the amount of crime, and so on, all coming together, scaling in the same way across the globe. And that leads to this extraordinary open-ended growth, which is the thing that we love, but also may be taking us over the edge of a cliff. It also is the origin of our speeding up of the pace of our lives. Our life gets faster, so that living in a bigger city, you have to innovate faster and faster to keep up with things in a systematic way.
There's also a very interesting question, which is, given that we have a global population that is booming, and there are real questions about whether the Earth can sustain this population, is high-density living basically the key to future human success?
If we insist on open-ended growth, then putting people in bigger and bigger cities is a continuous way of saving.
Well, there's also just the question of, can a city be too big to be livable? So, I mean, do you really want to live in a city of 30 million people?
Well, that's a very good question. The evidence that people are continually attracted to cities because of this extraordinary increase in their well-being, despite the fact that they may even have to live for these periods in slums and favelas, nevertheless, is a continuous attraction of cities. And I think there is this kind of image always that you can do much better in cities. And that's true. That is the truth.
You can do better economically.
You can do better economically. And that seems to be the driving force. People always want more. You know, and if that is the principle, then it follows that these cities will continue to grow.
Is that to say that cities could just keep expanding? Well, you could have 100 million inhabitants in a city?
In one way, the answer is yes. On the other, what is a city? So in this framework, roughly speaking, it is everybody that's somehow connected to the network. So the question is, could this network grow to encompass 100 million people? That may be unlikely because take Los Angeles. We already have maybe 15 million people, but it already has, you know, 12-lane freeways going through.
There are only so many lanes you can
so
add
then
to
the
a freeway.
Exactly. So that brings the question, if you have 100 million people and you want them all to be part of this network and we still have the same transportation system, we're going to have, you know, 25-lane freeways, I mean, to make it absurd, maybe. That is clearly impossible. So it could be that there's a stopping of cities or that they bifurcate.
Mm-hmm. So here you are, the physicist who studies cities.
Yes.
You're gathering all kinds of data. You're coming up with general laws as to how cities work. Are there policy implications here? I mean, should urban planners be listening to what you're coming up with?
Yes, very good question, and a question we ponder quite a bit. So here's my kind of little cartoon version. To build an aeroplane, you don't have to know any science, but you have to have very good intuition, and you have to be a very good tinkerer. That's what the Wright brothers were, in a sense. But you try building a Boeing 747, not knowing hydrodynamics, aerodynamics, and materials, and so on. So you can't scale unless you understand. And scale is critical for the resilience, growth, and evolution of cities. So I would say, to be quite provocative about it, I think we are dealing with cities much as if we're Wright brothers. What it desperately needs is to develop that science, to have the underlying theories, bring them together with the traditional, more qualitative, narrative way of thinking about them. It can't be done piecemeal and locally. Overall, you need to think systemically and to understand what the underlying laws are and what it is that's driving them. And what is driving them is the social networks, the interaction of people. And a successful city has somehow been able to facilitate the multiple interactions that give rise to the buzz, the excitement, facilitating the creativity of a city.
So how do you do that? I mean, does that just happen, or can you actually plan for that?
Well, I think you can understand some of that. So one of the things that we did was we looked at the scaling laws. So the scaling laws say, give me the size of the city. It says you should have, you know, this many police, you should be producing this many patents, you should have this much crime, this many AIDS cases, okay, et cetera, et cetera. So, of course, when you look at each individual city, you see that it violates each one of these. It either over or underperforms relative to, quote, what it should be doing. So what we did is we took data from the 366 metropolitan statistical areas of the United States. Are they over or underperforming? And asking, what is it that you're doing in that city that has led to you either being lousy, you're hardly producing any patents relative to what you should, or you're having more crime than you should, or you're overperforming. And one of the most interesting things about these kinds of data was that if a city was overperforming in, say, 1960, 1970, roughly speaking, it's over or underperforming to the same degree now. It tells you something very important for planners, that it's very hard to change things.
If there's one question out there you wish you could answer regarding cities, you as the physicist, you know,
yes,
trying to figure out how cities work, you know, what makes the best, the most livable city, what would that one question be?
Well, the question that that drives this for me is any of this sustainable? Cities are the manifestation of who we are, the best of human achievement in many ways, and some of its worst aspects. They continue to grow and dominate the planet. But what is clear to me is that we cannot do it with the kind of open-ended exponential growth that we have, because I think any physicist knows that you cannot sustain exponential growth ad infinitum. Is there a maximum size for cities? Can they just kind of go on? Could you imagine a city of 100 million people? Well, the biggest city at the moment is Tokyo with 35 million, and there are many now so-called mega cities. Tokyo is somewhat unique that it's clearly a highly functioning, well-run city. Many of those other mega cities, especially in Africa and India, are kind of borderline because of these pressures. And I remind you of the statistic I said at the beginning, 1.5 million people a week. You realize what that is? That means that every 2 months, the equivalent to New York metropolitan area, not just New York City, New York metropolitan area is being added effectively to the planet. So between now and, I don't know, the beginning of December, there's another New York metropolitan area. By the beginning of February, another one, and so on for the next 25, 30 years. That's mind-blowing, actually. This makes me, I must say, quite cynical about our ability to cope with that. I mean, the stress on infrastructure, the stress on resources, energy, things like, you know, water, and so forth. And in the end, the stresses on the social fabric may actually be too much, that we simply can't sustain it.
Jeffrey West is a theoretical physicist with the Santa Fe Institute. You can hear the extended version of Steve's conversation with him on our website at ttbook.org. And if you want to share urbane quotes from West with your friends, it's easy. Just follow us on Twitter. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Today we're taking a look at our human future, and that human future is urban. Here's more of Anne Strainchamps and Chris Anderson imagining the city of tomorrow.
One of the reasons people get scared about the future is they think of a billion Chinese and a billion Indians coming out of poverty into middle class and imagining them taking on the lifestyle that America, say, has had. And if you give all those people a McMansion and two cars, and then add up the sums on carbon footprint and what that means, basically, we're screwed. And so the question is, could they leapfrog that model to a better lifestyle model that both has more community and much lower carbon footprint? You could make the case that the right type of city could offer that.
It's so exciting when you think about it. I mean, what you're really saying is, think about the iconic cities that we all love, and we have a chance to build the next one.
That's right, and I don't know that anyone knows exactly what it will look like. There's just so much opportunity for the world's architects, urban planners, designers, inventors, citizens to engage and to take into account some of the stuff we've learned over the last 50 years. You know, humans are such complicated animals. They can't be thought of as just having these simple needs of, oh, I need this space, and I need this food, and I need this place to work or live or sleep. We care about things like light. We care about things like nature. We care about things like proximity to other people. And
beauty.
And some of those things in the last 50 years have driven people out of the cities because cities were ugly and dangerous and stressful. From that vantage point, we've suddenly discovered that we've lost soul, we've lost community, we've lost life and culture, and created these incredibly expensive, wasteful lifestyles that the planet can't sustain. So can we take all of these learnings and create something different, a vibrant living city that brings people together, allows less dependence on expensive forms of transport, more time spent in community and culture, still have some kind of experience with nature? Can we invent this rich, wonderful, thrilling life? I just don't think that there's a bigger design project on the planet right now.
Architects, urban planners, designers, inventors, and citizens have helped shape the cities we know. So have zoning plans and city codes. In fact, those laws are the DNA of any city, according to Arizona State urban planning professor Emily Tallon. Steve asked her to walk him through the rules that shape an ordinary street in her Phoenix neighborhood.
There's a rule about street width. There's a rule about how wide the lanes can be. There's a rule about how many lanes you can have. There's a rule about where the street trees go. There are rules about how wide the sidewalk is, about how wide the driveway, the curb cut, the setback of the building. All of these dimensions are affected by rules.
And how tall the buildings can be. And I'm assuming a big one also is whether you can mix commercial buildings, businesses, with residential neighborhoods.
Yes, exactly. That's one of the big rules that's driving a lot of developers crazy.
So how important are these codes in the way cities work?
Well, I think they're amazingly important, but also underappreciated by a lot of people. We think about big master plans, Daniel Burnham type, you know, drawings. Here's the kind of city you're going to get. But it's actually the day-to-day incremental decisions that traffic engineers or the myriad of different people that are affecting the urban environment. It's that incremental change that adds up to an awful lot over time.
So you're really talking about bureaucracy here. But I'm assuming that there are deeper values behind these rules.
Yep. The rules can also be social mores of different kinds. You know, you can point to a lot of interesting cases like the traditional Islamic city. It wasn't about bureaucracy, but it was about very strong social rules, religious rules about separation, about what's appropriate for facing the street, all kinds of conditions that were part of the social custom.
So when you look at the codes that are part of the fabric of city life in America, what are some of the underlying values that you see there?
Well, that's a good question, because it used to be that the values of, you know, what kinds of cities we were going for was very explicitly translated into a rule. For example, we want to have some mix between single-family homes and apartment buildings, but it can only be of a certain kind. I think the values we're seeing now are much more social separation. By dictating the size of a house, the size of a lot, how many units can be on a lot, those are all ways of socially separating. And that's been used pretty nefariously in the U.S. It's talked about an awful lot, and we really need to change that.
So you're saying most of these rules don't really work anymore?
I think a lot of rules that we have, nobody has any idea why we have those rules. Who said that a house has to be set back from the street 20 feet? Why isn't it 25 feet? Why isn't it 30 feet? How were these things determined? When we first started developing these rules in the early 20th century, we had a much clearer idea about why we had particular rules.
So if we put this in some historical perspective, how far back do modern city codes go?
Well, the first zoning came out of 1870s Germany. But, you know, zoning actually goes back to ancient Roman times, when the Romans said, in the center of the city, buildings can only be this high and streets can only be this wide. Further out from the center of the city, that was a different set of rules. So in the 1870s, the Germans really formalized it for the first time, and it was highly successful. The rules were so simple. Like, the whole zoning code was on one page, and it just showed a map, and it had four or five different zones, and it says, okay, in the center city, we want our buildings to be closer together and taller. In the outskirts, we want our buildings to be a little further apart and maybe not have, you know, industry next to single-family homes, but just a few simple rules. In the early 1900s, when they were transferred to the American context, they had that kind of nuance. They had that kind of mixture of flexibility and predictability. And then it's just sort of a story of people taking a good idea too far and trying to make zoning solve all kinds of social problems that they perceived. People started to figure out, hey, I could make sure that my neighborhood doesn't have any poor people. So you had this sort of homogeneity built into each one of the zones. There are people out there that are very active in trying to reform existing zoning. And the planners of America, of which there are 45,000 of them implementing these codes every day, they know that the rules that they are now working with are a problem, a big problem. We have rules like setback rules that are all about separating cities and making them more dispersed. We need cities to be more compact.
Do we know that people actually prefer to live in higher density cities?
We do. You know, there's been a lot of surveys done of people. At least 30% of the population would like to live in dense, walkable, compact, transit-served urbanism. Nowhere near 30% of the U.S. population lives that way. Then if you look at the demographics and what we have moving in the next 20, 30 years, we've got much smaller households. We've got many more single-person households, the boomers who are empty nesters. You know, all these demographics are about small household size. The supply is not there. And as a result, a lot of these communities, nice urban places are completely unaffordable.
Do you see this changing? How do you go about trying to convince city planners to rewrite the rules?
There is a movement out there, and it's called form-based codes. There are people out there that are very active in trying to reform existing zoning, getting the public involved, showing them, here's how these changes will affect your neighborhood. And 10, 20 years from now, you'll really see a change. You'll see more walkable, dense, mixed-use, compact urbanism.
So when you talk about form-based codes, what does that mean?
Okay, so form-based codes is a term that's been broadly applied to this reform idea. Let's not have these layers and layers of legal speak without seeing graphically what we're actually getting, without visualizing what we're getting. In other words, the form of the city becomes paramount. If you look at a zoning map right now, it's just a hodgepodge of zones all over the place. In Phoenix, in my book, I think I counted like 200-some different zones in the city. And the pattern makes no sense. It's so perverse the way attention to zoning and to uses produced not a good city, it produced the opposite.
But don't a lot of people actually get nervous when you start talking about changing city codes? Property values might go down, or this big business might suddenly move in next door. Do you have to sort of deal with people's fears when you start talking about changing these regulations?
That is a bit of a hard sell. Absolutely. People get nervous. They think it's all about property value. You have to get them to think bigger picture. The end game here, the end goal, is to create communities that are walkable and diverse and compact and transit served.
Want a different view on city rules? Emily Tallon's put together an image gallery from around the globe, going back decades. You can find a link to it and to her book on our website, ttbook.org.
It seems to me that American cities are in a state of constant decline and rebirth, and reinvention and falling apart. And there are a lot of challenges out there, but somehow or another people on the ground are kind of figuring it out.
Al Leston is the host and creator of the public radio program State of the Reunion. Anne asked him what inspired the show.
I felt for a long time that a lot of what I was seeing in the news media about communities and cities and locations wasn't really reflecting what I was seeing on the ground. I was a flight attendant for about 9 years. But also while I was doing that, I was a performance poet. And so I was performing all over the country. Every place has challenges. And so you hear all of these stories about this bad thing happening or that bad thing happening. And I saw a lot of that, but I also saw, you know, communities coming together.
So you've brought in some clips for us from some of the people you've talked to, interviewed for, on the radio. Let's start with the story you found in Birmingham.
We had some kids coming because band was dropped in their school and they had no place to go and they couldn't afford lessons. And we're getting a lot of kids from the rural suburbs of Birmingham that are the same thing. They just, it isn't offered in their school.
Who's that?
That was Jean Goforth, and she's great. Like, basically what's happening in Birmingham is the same thing that's happening across the country. When we talk about education, the first things that get cut are the music programs and the art programs and so forth and so on. And Jean saw that happening all around her, and she decided she was going to do something to change it. And so she cashed in her entire life savings and started this program called Scrollworks. Kids from all over the Birmingham area can come in and get free music lessons. You walk in there, and it's organized chaos because there are kids everywhere. And in all these little classrooms at this church, you'll find kids learning how to play instruments. And since it's gotten started, you know, it's just been a lot of people volunteering their time, giving her donations. And Jean's also really smart. I mean, she knows how to work the system and get what she needs out of it. That's one thing I generally see across the country is that you have a leader who has a vision, and that person puts a staff around them that are just, you know, really a smart group of individuals to help navigate the waters in order to keep the programs going.
And the other thing about a project like that is that'd be a great project to replicate in dozens of cities around the country, which is, I guess, your point. If we don't know about the stuff that's happening, if we don't hear about a project like Jeans, then another city doesn't have a chance to replicate it.
Exactly.
So the next clip you brought is also about ordinary citizens making changes.
It's the opposite of going out and fighting. There may be fighting, but it's completely different. You're not picking up a gun, you're picking up a broom. You're not driving around in an armored personnel carrier. You're driving around just in your car, moving from block to block to see what needs to be picked up. I mean, it's the same, but different.
Okay, who's that? What's the story?
Yeah, that was Jeremy Johnson. He is a retired Marine. He's in Baltimore, and him and a few of his friends started this organization called the Sixth Branch. And basically, it's the sixth branch of the military. You know, they all serve their time in the other five branches, and when they come back home, reentry can be tough. And so they started finding ways to use the skills that they have learned in the military to help their community. They adopted one neighborhood, the Oliver neighborhood. And in that neighborhood, they are just doing projects there to make the neighborhood safer, to clean it up.
How much change has Sixth Branch made in their community, do you think?
I think the residents of that neighborhood will tell you that it's made change there. I think you may not see like this monumental change, but that's what I see all across the country, is that change plays out in different ways. And it's not so much about what the outside eye picks up on, but more what the people who live there pick up on. For me, it wasn't so much about the results as much as it is about the action. In NOLA, Father Bill Terry, he just got tired of all the senseless violence that was happening in New Orleans, and no one really seems to worry about it because it's only happening in the black neighborhoods. And so in order to bring attention to it, several years ago, he started this murder board where he would write down the names, ages, and I believe there's a little bit of information about how they died, but he'd write it down on a big permanent whiteboard in front of his church. Mostly the people that go to his church are white parishioners, but you know, the names that are on this board are of all sorts of people, and he doesn't make judgments. He doesn't say, well, this guy was a gangbanger, this guy was a drug dealer, and so he doesn't go on the board. It's like, no, all these people are human beings, and they have a right to their dignity, regardless of what they did in life.
In the news, night after night, reports a murder here, a murder there. In the past week, we've had 10 murders, to give you an idea. My wife turned to me and said, where was that murder? I said, oh, don't worry. It's on the other side of St. Claude. It's not in our neighborhood. Oh, okay. We went back to our business. The very next night at midnight, pop, 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 right outside the front door. There was a 17-year-old man shot to death with his girlfriend, who was wailing in a voice that sounded like Irish King. It was an otherworldly wail. The police prevented me from approaching the boy for fear of, quotes, contaminating the scene. I couldn't give the kid last rites. I think that we all have to be responsible for the actions of every citizen in our city. We may not be our brother's keeper, but we certainly hold their lives, or should hold their lives, as sacred.
That's when I was asking him, like, so what has this changed? Like, has this slowed down the violence? Has it done anything? And that's when he told me, you know, it's not so much about looking at the result. It's much more about doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do.
It's a powerful thing. He's bearing witness.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, sometimes individuals' projects wind up getting wings of some kind. They spread beyond their individual city. And that's kind of the story behind Will Allen's Growing Power, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, let's hear a little clip.
For us to be able to do 1 million pounds of compost right here in this neighborhood without pissing off the neighbors, you know, you have to engage the community so they look at what you're doing as an asset.
Will lives just down the turnpike a bit from us here in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. So he's, think of him as a native son. But tell us about Growing Power.
I really wanted to meet Will Allen. And what Growing Power does is basically they are in what you would classify as a food desert in Milwaukee. And he created a farm. And on that farm, in the middle of basically the inner city, he does all these different type of farming methods where they use like every inch of land. Here's a clip from one of the guys that actually works at Growing Power.
We're on about 1.5 acres of growing space. We have 6 greenhouses, another 7 hoop houses, a variety of animals. We've got goats, turkeys, ducks, chicken, fish, and worms. And we're growing a variety of different foods.
And they create jobs in the neighborhood. He told me that he has never had to lay somebody off due to, you know, not having enough money. People are always employed. So it's creating jobs in the neighborhood, but it's also creating, you know, food for the neighborhood that normally wouldn't have access to the type of stuff that we can, most of us can get at a grocery store. In these food deserts, there aren't any grocery stores in the near area. And Will is just a really smart cat. I mean, you sit down and talk to him, and the way he looks at life and the way he looks at how we can make change. And he understands that, you know, it happens on the small scale. So he has a lot of classes where people from all over the world come in to learn how to do what he's doing. And the type of farming he does is called hydroponics, where basically you have 2 layers. The top layer is where you plant your vegetables and so forth. And then the bottom part of it is a trough, basically, that has fish in it as well. And I think at the time, the fish were mostly tilapia. And so basically the nutrients that come from the fish feed the plants, and then the nutrients that come from the plants feed the fish, and so it's a cycle. It's basically replicating what nature does already.
So he's not just feeding the neighborhood and growing food. He's created a model for this very high density fishing farming
exactly.
That can go on in the middle of an inner city.
Absolutely.
Al, if you were named sort of overseer of American cities, national policymaker for urban development, what kinds of things would you suggest?
Oh, wow. I don't want that title. I would say that the first thing that I would do is listen. That's what gets lost in our political process. And then the answers are right there in the community. So listen and then look at the people who are making change in their community and then create policies, basically, that support those people.
Well, Al, thank you for helping us listen. Thanks for finding all these stories.
Thank you so much.
That's Al Leston from State of the Reunion.
It's exciting to see in some cities, even somewhere like Detroit, to see some creative people moving back now and having a dream about. There's a creativity and an energy and a thrill that you can't get in the suburbs. You know, they didn't call that program Desperate Housewives without a reason. I think that the life of ideas, the life of culture, the life of learning is incredibly important.
More Chris Anderson and the art of city living coming up. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm TT book producer Sarah Nix. Part of what inspired this city's show is this great book by P.D. Smith called City, A Guidebook for the Urban Age. And I just want to read for you a little bit from the introduction. As a species, we've never been entirely satisfied with what nature gave us. We're the ape that shapes our environment, the city builders, Homo urbanus. Cities are our greatest creation. They embody our ability to imagine how the world might be and to realize those dreams in brick, steel, concrete, and glass. 200 years ago, only 3% of the world's population lived in cities. By 2050, 75% will be urbanites. The experience of living in cities is universal. The first city dwellers were the Sumerians in the south of Mesopotamia. For the Sumerians 7,000 years ago, Eden was not a garden, it was a city. The Sumerians did not long for some mythic rural idyll, an unobtainable Arcadia. They believed the city was the place where all their dreams would be realized. By about 2000 BC, 90% of Sumerians lived in cities. When the first city builders set out on their urban experiment, they created far more than a new man-made environment. In many respects, they were laying the foundations of modern urban life. Civilization as we know it today began in the city. City dwellers also created a new way of being. Urban communities formed revolutionary social and moral order that broke free from the rigid structures, the tribes and clans of the rural world. According to a medieval German saying, city air sets you free. In a city, you could liberate yourself from feudal bonds and become an individual. The city allows you to be whatever you want to be. In The Great Gatsby, when Nick Carraway glimpses the skyline of Midtown Manhattan with its first wild promise of all the mystery and the beauty in the world, he tells himself anything can happen now, anything at all. From ancient Memphis to Manhattan, the intense experience of urban life has turned cities into magnets, attracting the most talented people from the surrounding lands. Whether you were a Chinese peasant passing through the city walls of Nanjing in the 3rd century AD, a Muslim pilgrim entering bustling Baghdad 1,000 years ago, or a European immigrant arriving by ship in New York, those first impressions of the city are overwhelming. The crowds of people filling the alleys and streets, the din of the traffic, the bittersweet smell of humanity living cheek by jowl, buskers and beggars competing for your attention and your money, hawkers offering freshly cooked food, and shop windows stacked with goods from the four corners of the world at never-to-be-repeated prices. 2,500 years ago, a Greek poet praised cities as being places of opportunity and vision, where dreams are made and desires fulfilled. Cities were successful because they became centers of trade, creating work and wealth for their inhabitants, because they were safe and secure places to live, and because they offered an intense social and cultural life. In essence, life for the inhabitants of the first cities was not so very different from today. Cities bear the traces of countless past lives. The awareness of these ghosts as you walk through the city is one of the most important aspects of the urban experience. Cities are rich storehouses of human history. Even the structure of a new city harks back to earlier urbanisms and age-old dreams of a shining city on a hill.
I've spent years looking at cities and working on large-scale projects that try to integrate art into the public realm.
Artist Mary Miss.
I'm really trying to imagine a way that we can have cities come to understand a really essential role that the arts can play, and I've developed this framework called City as Living Laboratory. Artists can really be effective in making these complex issues that cities are dealing with apparent to the citizens of the city.
So what you're saying is that art has a role beyond dressing up a city. It is an opportunity to introduce people to the city they live in?
I think there's a wonderful opportunity to use art as a way to decode the city. For instance, people don't think about the infrastructure it takes to support their lives or the natural systems. And if you could do projects that call attention to that, that everybody at ground level gets to see walking along the street, there becomes this shared, or the possibility of a shared interest.
Maybe we can get some sense of it by talking about one of your recent projects. You did the Flow Project based on the White River in Indianapolis.
In Indianapolis, I realized that the river was very beautiful and bucolic looking, and it's kind of invisible. So people don't really pay that much attention to it. So I started to look at the river in detail and found out that 70% of the drinking water for the city was supplied by the river, and yet it was very polluted. So I started working with scientists and historians, and over a 2-year period, we developed this project to create 100 points along the river where aspects of its ecology, infrastructure, or history could be revealed. This started in a way because I started looking through this information that had been given to me, and it was frankly kind of boring. It wasn't engaging in any way, you know. So I developed these stopping points that consist of a mirror where you see yourself, but then there is a red mark on the surface of the mirror. Something is called out. It might be a fish hatchery in this area that I'm asking you to look at. To get you to note that area, I've put an oversized red map pin, a 6 or 12-inch diameter red ball, shiny red ball. And when you look in the mirror, you can align the mark on the mirror with that distant marker. So you can find out where the fish hatchery is. There's a number that you can dial up and listen to someone describing how things work in that lagoon area along the river. And so there are these almost acupuncture-like points along a six-mile stretch of river describing many different aspects, where a Civil War encampment had been or where the levee starts. So the place comes to be revealed. I think the mirror is really a great device for a situation like this because you get to see yourself in relation to that landscape, in relationship to the river.
It sounds as though you had a lot of enthusiastic response in the scientific community. What about city planners? What about officials in the city? Were they enthusiastic about this?
They were very supportive. And I think the city saw this as, oh, you know, here's a freebie. Somebody wants to help us communicate with citizens about these issues about water. And the best thing to come out of this project for me is that there is a group of citizens who've put together something called ROW, Reconnecting with Our Waterways, to make 6 of the tributaries that lead into the White River more apparent to people. It's being played out that artists really can have this major and very effective role communicating these issues.
What I like about this story is that it is not a case of a project being finished and then somebody saying, you know what would make this look nice is a nice statue over there. Let's find an artist who can plop one in there and it'll make everything fine. You flipped it, haven't you?
Right. And I think it's takes a while for people to understand a new definition of art. It isn't the, you know, guy on a horse in the park only, or the abstract sculpture in front of a building. But this was a great precedent project for me to show how this City is a Living Lab works. And now we're trying to do another project here in New York City, looking at another kind of corridor, the corridor of Broadway. We're going from the tip of Manhattan to the top of the Bronx. And our intention is to have up to 20 sites along that corridor where we reveal different aspects of the city, of the natural systems that support the city, of the infrastructure, because the city agencies in the last 12 years have been coming up with great plans. But I was interested in getting those ideas out on the street, at street level, because it seems to me it's fine to have the city agencies having these intentions, but unless you engage the citizens of the city, it's going to be a much longer process.
Of course, in a city the size of New York, there are millions of people involved, and getting them to stop and pay attention to anything is not simple, is it?
Well, in this case, I'm using convex mirrors that are almost like jewels or something. And New Yorkers aren't big on stopping for a long time, but they are really quick studies. You know, everybody's got their radar out all the time. So I think we did a test up at 137th Street, and we found that, yes, people did stop, and after these elements were out for a long period of time, they'd maybe stop again and bother to dial up and hear the story behind the mirror. Someone who was somewhat critical of the project said, I saw someone putting lipstick on in front of one of your mirrors. And I said, wow, great. You know, because I figure once they stop, they will see the content that I've got juxtaposed with that.
New Yorkers do have a reputation for being difficult to impress. When you did the test hub for the Broadway project, did you see how you'd have to tweak it to engage people?
Yes, it was done with support from the National Science Foundation. And you have to do a real serious evaluation. So someone was out there, an environmental psychologist, talking to people before the installation went up, during the installation. And we found out that people were becoming more aware of the issues of the environment by the end of the 3-month period.
Is there something about beauty, too, aesthetics anyway? Is it because of the practice of visual and spatial communication that artists have a unique job to do in helping people see their cities?
Beauty is a very complex issue, but how something's made, the craft of the making of the object, things aren't believable unless they're done in a way that really makes sense with the issue. So it's that layering together of content, if you can get people to have a direct experience of something rather than only walking the surface of a place, if I can get people to just think briefly about the connections of everything that they touch, breathe, eat, and do in the city, make that tangible in just some small way, that will satisfy me.
And presumably it allows people, perhaps encourages people to become enthusiastic about things that planning commissions have made seem dull.
I think that's the main thing. I've worked on many different city-scale projects in St. Louis or Milwaukee or other places in the country. And I've just come to have such an appreciation of the richness, the possibilities of cities. I want to find a way to help us reimagine them. You know, the city can be remade, but people have to not be hit over the head and told that they should do things differently. I'm trying to get them interested in these issues. It's not trying to give people vinegar water all the time. It's really trying to get people interested. And I think citizens are greatly underestimated. If you can just give them an access point, I think there's a chance of engaging interest, and that's the first step that I can see in getting us to reimagine our cities.
You can find links to Mary Miss's projects on our website, ttbook.org. So what can you do to help shape our urban future? Earlier I said that the 2012 TED Prize went to The City 2.0. Anne asked Chris Anderson what that means.
So the TED Prize basically initiated a kind of call for collaborative action, imagining this City 2.0. What kind of ideas have come up so far?
So far what we've done is create a platform which allows citizens in any city to connect with each other and build an idea, a project, and then share it with others so that it becomes a learning resource for other people. You know, if you imagine in a city, you know, a few hundred citizens going out and snapping photographs of different parts of the city and then tagging them about what they like and don't like about that, and then uploading them, and those being perhaps weaved together to become a kind of a mind map of the city. What design ideas could you get from that? We're expecting over the next year to see some really amazingly imaginative and beautiful projects bubble up from individual cities, and then we hope to spread.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org. And if you want to buff up on, say, the history of hip, the nature of consciousness, the education debates, or cult authors, you can find all that and more in our mighty audio archive. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook or Twitter as well. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for City Living. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Sarah Nix, with the help of Ann Strainchamps, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. And thanks to our friends at freesound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.